right, we're going to be talking to Representative Amanda Price this morning, and just because the representatives are on vacation, I guess I should put that in quotes, because they're busy anyhow, right, Amanda?
We are very busy.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. All right, what are you busy with?
Well, specifically myself, I have four work groups that I'm participating in this summer. One has to do with Common Core, and so we've had some testimony of that on education. Common Core was somewhat of a point of stalling the budget earlier this year, and mm-hmm. so we asked that we take a deeper look at it this summer, and so I was appointed to the subcommittee to do that and serving as vice chair of that subcommittee. So we've met twice. We will meet two more times.
Okay.
There's a public notices work group going on, so local units of government have to publish a lot of notices
right.
having to do with anything from changing the district, the boundaries of your cemetery, to elections and tax increases. So we're looking at the number of times local units of government have to publish a certain thing. So, for instance, the changing the boundaries of a cemetery, you have to publish 5 times.
Mm.
It's an old law.
Yeah.
So, and now we're trying to make it a little bit more uniform and bring the cost down for local units of government, but at the same time make sure that the public has adequate notice, and trying to move some of these items possibly to websites that are available for the local units
yeah.
of government.
Yeah.
So it's a big cost savings to locals. But we're looking at, I think, 290 different laws right now.
Mm.
So it's a little intimidating at times and very confusing, because some of them are old and you don't even know what this means. Like, for instance, there's one called a notice of a distrained beast.
Mm.
So we're not even sure what that is. And so a lot of it's going back 100 years and figuring out why was this put into law, and why do we even need this today?
Yeah.
Can we repeal this law?
I think we could.
I think so, too. You're never sure if people's even have anyone's ever used it. And some of them we're finding completely worthy of repeal because it's just not used, or it has, the county government's changed, and some of this was in place
right.
when there were the township
board of supervisors.
Right. So
yeah.
It's really kind of going back into history. It's kind of a fun look. So
mm-hmm.
other one we're looking at, we have going is how do we encourage consolidation of governments or consolidation of services? And that one's a little bit more difficult, primarily because people really like where they live.
Yes.
And they don't want to give up their identity of their place. It's a pride of place, and you know this, being a resident of the
yeah.
Saugatuck area, that's an ongoing discussion.
Should we make it Saugatuck or Dugatuck?
Or the city of the village of the...
Yes.
Yeah, so that's an ongoing discussion. We're finding there are some discrepancies in how you want to... for instance, if a township wanted to become a city... Or,
mm-hmm.
you know, why do they have to go to the Boundary Commission? You know, things like that. So
yeah.
we're working through that. And then the final one is a work group on looking at the statutory revenue sharing that the state gives to local units of government. And while the constitutional revenue sharing that the state gives out is per capita. So for every unit, you get, it's based on the population.
Yeah.
Statutory revenue sharing has a different formula, and even more different than originally intended, because the governor came in and changed that a little bit to be an economic incentive vitality payment. And disproportionately, that money goes to Detroit. So about 58% of the statutory revenue sharing right now goes to the city of Detroit. And we're looking at, does that make sense?
Yeah.
and if it doesn't make sense, how do we allocate it more fairly to cities, villages, and townships across the state? Do you do it based on the population? Do you do it per capita? Do you do it because cities have a higher infrastructure burden than maybe a rural township. So that's an interesting discussion as well.
I heard the other day you could buy a house for a dollar down in Detroit.
Yeah, yeah, I think you can. And yeah, there's large tracts of land that I think are being made into somewhat urban farms.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I'm interested in the Common Core, I think. What's happening on that? Did that emanate from the Department of Education?
No, it's actually interesting history of it. So back in 1995, there was a large international study, benchmarking study of all the education systems across the industrialized countries. And the results came out in 1997, and the United States didn't do particularly well. It was a math and science benchmarking study. And that got the attention of several governors and some business folks. And from that, they said, you know, we should probably be doing a little bit better. And what was of note was that a lot of governors thought you couldn't, for instance, if you had a business in Michigan, go to maybe Mississippi or Alabama and have that same level of education product in the students. So they wanted to somewhat standardize what students would be educated in across the country. And this then kept gaining more momentum. The National Governors Association came on board and developed this Common Core standard. And it's hard to explain because a lot of folks think it is a curriculum. And really, it is a standard. And so, in talking with this with my husband, who is an automotive engineer, I think the best way for me to describe it is something similar to a lot of manufacturing processes. We went through the international standards, the ISO standards. And it, what the ISO standards did for a company was say, okay, here's the standard we want you to achieve. And we want you to reduce, you know, your manufacturing process time, your waste time, you know, your waste product. We're not going to tell you how to get there, but this is the standard you have to achieve. And that's very similar to the Common Core standards. We want you to have children at this level, but we're not going to tell you how to get there. So, for instance, last week I met with a curriculum director at West Ottawa, and he said we were on course to buy a whole set of new books for our math department. But the teachers said, you know, we don't think we need to buy new textbooks. We can develop this information and this what the students need to learn by ourselves, pulling information from whatever resources they have. And so it's not a curriculum. You're not buying a curriculum, but you are being held to a standard to educate those children to.
Does it apply to the curriculum at all? I mean, in what is taught in the schools?
As I understand it, and again, I'm not an educator, I'm not a curriculum person, where before the standards that were in place had the teachers teaching a wide range of things, you know, 40 topics in a year, this will consolidate it or shrink those topics down to fewer, but they'll go deeper. So if you had 40 subjects that you had to hit in a class during the year, you couldn't go very deep.
Right.
But if you've got, you know, for instance, 10 topics, you can go much deeper, and the learning opportunities can be much deeper in those topics. And so I think there is, I still don't think it drives the curriculum. There will be a standardized test put in place, and I think there's two different varieties of it. And so that you can measure across the state and then across the country as to how your students are measuring.
I guess I was wondering, you know, like if you move from one place to another, are your kids going to be able to pick up the books and say, okay, we were here? And
yeah, again, I think it's how each individual school district will choose to deliver what they need.
A standard.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, it can have a whole different look to it if you are in, for instance, the Inno Academy in New Zealand versus maybe West Ottawa. And so it does depend on a a parent's choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's going to be complicated.
It is complicated. Well, actually, I've heard some educators say that this is the best thing they've ever seen come along.
Oh, well, maybe so.
And so while it is a complicated thing to understand and maybe implement immediately, it may prove to be better than what we have in place.
Mm-hmm.
And as most people say, nothing's perfect, and there will be bugs in everything as you implement something.
It's just not going to be a one-size-fits-all.
No, no. And it will give the local school districts what we pride ourselves on in Michigan is local control. And I think that's a really good benefit.
I always wonder about parental input. If it's, you know, if parents have any input, is while we're buying new school books, you want to look at them or not.
Right. Right. Aside from the school board members who do review them. Yeah. And that may be a little different. If, for instance, if West Ottawa is choosing to forego the use of textbooks and use other math curriculum or things that are available to the teachers, you know, parents may not have the ability to look just solely at a textbook, but maybe look at online resources,
mm-hmm.
and other materials that the teachers can pull.
So when is this study going to be?
We will be completing that, I believe, at the end of August, and then we will, we're not sure if we have to make a recommendation or what happens at that point, but it's interesting. We've had a lot of national level speakers, and it's quite controversial. Lots of crowded committee rooms.
I can imagine. Teachers and parents and all that.
Teachers, parents, educators, business folks. Very interested in it.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Good morning. You're online with our guest.
Oh, good morning, Miss Price.
Mm-hmm.
From what you're saying about Common Core, it's totally opposite of what I've been hearing nationally. I understand it's going to take all control away and give it to the national level. Plus, it's going to do biometrics on the students. In other words, fingerprinting, eyeball reading, and all this kind of stuff. So parents are going to have no say or no input whatsoever what happens to their children in the schools from here on out. It's Common Core is adopted. Now, Indiana turned it down, if you want to check into that, see why. And other states are turning it down. I think Texas has, and I'm not sure how many states. I think 11 states. But I'd like you to look into it further before you get on board with this.
Well, and thank you for that. I have heard the same thing, that it's going to be national control, biometrics. We have asked those questions of the folks who have testified in front of us, and I have not heard that that's the case. There is no biometrics being done. The students' testing will, of course, be tied to their individual identifying number, but they won't be having the fingerprinting and the...
Yeah. The problem is, you know, you start small and then it grows big, just like the NSA is doing with everything now. So I'd be very cautious.
Yeah. Oh, and the national control piece, again, the local units of government, or not the units, the local school districts,
mm-hmm.
will be accountable to implementing those standards. And
yeah, that's the problem, though, and I understand the parents will have no input whatsoever. So that's what I'm hearing on mm-hmm. the national level. This is what I'm hearing from all my data, and thank God I have no children in the public schools anymore. They went to the public schools, but after what I hear about Common Core, I'm not so sure I'd ever put them in the school anymore. But please look into it and be cautious.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I do know, I've heard about Texas and Indiana. 45 states have implemented the Common Core standards. And that's why we're taking a pause right now to mm-hmm. look at that and process through this in the next month.
Well, we have a program on Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, Issues in Education, and I listen to them sometimes, and I'm hearing that in some schools now that Islam is mandatory, and they have to buy a textbook, of course, which is the Koran, and all this sort of things going on in the public schools.
Mm.
And I think this is something we have to be aware of.
Yeah. I agree.
And I know that I don't think you'd approve of that either.
No, similarly, I don't think... that's interesting to me, because I don't think you can teach from the Bible in public schools.
Right, Right.
So to have the Quran taught in public schools is interesting.
Right. All right. Let's continue with more of these things you're doing.
Well, one of the things I have been asking for about, well, since got into office, is to have a standing subcommittee in the Education Committee on Early Childhood Education. And we are moving forward with that. The speaker has said, let's do that. The education chair has allowed me to move forward with that. And so we're pulling together both folks on the Democratic and Republican side to have a standing committee, because there's really no oversight of what happens in early childhood education,
right,
daycare, health care. And so we're going to be starting that focus in September. It will not be completely of the education committee, but we'll have outside members as well.
Good morning. You're online with our guest.
Yeah, just to comment about that, with that lady talking about the Corps, I think I agree with her. And the rules are going to come from Washington. The local people will not have anything to say. You're going to get something like Obamacare. You don't have any control over that. So that's my comment. Thanks, Amanda.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
So the Early Childhood Education Subcommittee will take a look at, hopefully, that, you know, what's the level of need for early childhood education.
Mm-hmm.
Do we even need, I mean, as a subcommittee, will we look at daycare needs and health care? And then find more ways to evaluate the effectiveness of early childhood. A lot of us think, and I know Joe Hobman feels this way, I feel this way, that good quality early childhood education can avert some of the costs of not only kind of remedial education, but longer term, if you educate and get a child reading, for instance, by the third grade, it's a great indicator that they will not have prison in their future. So this is really important, and we'll put some really strong looks at early childhood.
Where would we start the education? Three, two?
Well, you know, early childhood education begins with the parents. So
yes,
the parents reading to kids and playing with kids and just talking to them every day, describing what they see, you know, the pink walls or the blue balloon. A very high indicator of your success in school is how big your vocabulary is at certain levels, you know, 3 and 4 year old levels. So the more parents talk to kids, don't plop them in front of a television set. Just talk to
Good
them.
Good luck.
Yeah, because they found that kids learn better when parents are talking to them and describing things to them. And so we will be trying to figure out how that parents can get that message a little bit more than they do now,
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the parents have to be available to do that. The
parents have to be available, and like I've talked about before, we have a large percentage of our parents right now in single parents.
Yeah.
And so that makes it even more difficult to really educate children, especially at those early levels.
Mm-hmm. And now some hours are being cut, so people have to get two jobs to make enough money.
Right.
And that means more hours working.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad.
It is. It is. That's the implications of the Obamacare stuff. I think we're seeing
some
folks. Yeah,
it's all headed in the wrong direction.
I agree. It's
an
interesting policy that we're hurting the middle class by putting in this health care policy.
They can't seem to understand that in Washington. No, not yet.
Yeah, it's interesting.
All right. How many people are on this study groups usually?
It depends on the group. I think on the Common Core group there are about 12.
Mm-hmm.
The other ones are much smaller groups. The subcommittee on early childhood is probably going to be about 14. And so it's a good group. Because
this actually doesn't give you much vacation time as such, does it?
No, and that's okay. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. The other complicating factor is my son is getting married in a few weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's, you know, always a busy
time
thinking about and helping plan for that. So
of course, not as busy for you as it is for the bride's parents.
Right. That's the advantage of maybe having two sons.
Yeah. Right. Okay. What else is going on in Lansing? Is there anything going on in Lansing right now?
You know, the Senate, there was a committee meeting last week. The Government Operations Committee voted on recommending the Medicaid bill. And actually, they made some several changes to the House bill and added those changes to the existing bill. But then there were two other senators, Senator Colbeck and Senator Caswell, who had different versions of possible expansion. I shouldn't use that word. Possible health care coverage programs. I think Senator Caswell's was a state-based plan so that we would do it wholly inside the state, pay for it ourselves. And Senator Colbeck's had to do with health savings accounts and some other mechanisms. So all three of those bills are passed out of the committee, will go to the Senate, get voted on, and then the House, at least the first one, will likely come over to the House, and we'll take a look at it. Probably the other two, if they pass the...
Maybe go to conference.
Yeah. And maybe what will happen is some of the good ideas in Senator Colbeck or Caswell bills will be integrated into the Lori bill on the Medicaid. So we'll see. And I'm still reading through all the changes that the Senate made to the to that bill itself. So
a lot of reading, isn't there?
It is, yeah. And then finally, you know, the Detroit bankruptcy issue is taking a lot of discussion points. I'm learning a lot of what the Chapter 9 bankruptcy means for municipal government, what our role is in it, if there is any role, and what it will look like. And day by day, you see articles about the bankruptcy, and especially in the Wall Street Journal, about what it could mean. The plan, I know I read today that the lawyers for the city of Detroit are hoping to have a reorganization plan by the end of this year, which is a few months ahead of schedule, according to the bankruptcy filing. So we'll see. I mean, hopefully they will move very quickly with it.
And well, the sooner they move with it, the sooner we can get started on the rebuilding.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, over the weekend I was reading that the list of creditors is 3,504 pages long. And so it's
a lot of bondholders, you know, for various projects in Detroit are going to get stung, I'm sure.
Pension obligations are there. And how does the city then come out of that better? Yeah, so I believe it weighs on all of our minds.
It does.
As legislators and citizens. And we just hope the best for Detroit.
Detroit is Michigan, and Michigan is Detroit, too. And that's the way it is, and whether you like it or not.
Yeah, you know, whoever you meet, you know, they say, well, do you live in Detroit? And you say, no, I live, you know, 3.5 hours away, but it doesn't matter.
But there's a lot of different facets to Detroit. I mean, you get in the fancier districts to the north, and it's only a few miles away, really, but what a difference.
Yeah, and downtown is just booming and beautiful, and then there's miles of sometimes vacant land between the pockets of development around the state, so, or around the city.
Maybe we make farmland out of it and make some money on it.
Yeah, I had an idea the other day that whoever still has an existing home should be able to pick up, you know, 2 or 3 acres around them.
Yes.
And then that's a way to, you know, enhance their property value. But yeah, one idea. They've got several, I'm sure.
Well, Amanda, we're out of time, and I thank you very much for being our guest this morning and telling us about the various issues that you are working on and the House is working on as well.
Thank you very much, and you have a wonderful rest of the summer.